This is Tax Chats. Hello, I'm Scott Dyring.
And I am Jeff Hoops.
And we're here to chat
about taxes.
Hello again, and welcome to another edition of Tax Chats. I'm Scott Dyring, professor of accounting at Duke University, and I am joined, as always, by my friend and colleague and curator of the Tax Museum at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Jeff Hoops. Hello, Jeff.
Hello.
What's happening over there in the Tax Museum today?
Same thing as always.
A whole lot of nothing.
A whole lot of amazing everything.
Yeah, okay. I'll bet at night things come alive, kind of like in that Night at the Museum movie. I'll bet that's what happens in the Tax
Museum.
Could
be. I'm rarely here at night.
Yeah.
Although I do have a bucket list goal of one time sleeping in my office all night long. So when I do that.
You haven't done it yet?
I've never done it, no.
You better be careful. The things might come alive when you do.
At Michigan, there are a few PhD students who like would regularly sleep in their cubes, and they just grind it out. You get your few hours of sleep and wake back up at 4 a.m. and get back at it.
Well, now I know you don't work hard enough because you actually go home at night. So, yeah, okay.
I don't have a couch in my office like you do to sleep on either.
True. I do have a couch, and I do occasionally take a nap, and I'm not ashamed of that. Although I did not admit that until post-tenure. So there you go. So, Jeff, tell us what we have going on today.
So we are making Tax Chats history today, doing something we've never done before. So we have with us Ben Allery, and that name might sound familiar to all three loyal Tax Chats listeners because he was recently on Tax Chats. And we basically started chatting about what Ben does and some of the cool stuff that his company is doing. And we realized there's so much more to talk about. And so right when we got off, we booked another time to chat. And so here we are for basically version two of chatting with Ben Allery.
Hang on. Why is this Tax Chats history?
Because we've never talked with the same person about the same thing twice. We've talked with the same person twice.
About different
things.
But also
we didn't book it simultaneously.
True, yes, okay.
Yeah, I know you're trying to be like the Tax Chats historian on me, but no.
Yeah.
You're not. I'm the Tax Chats historian.
Yeah.
Okay, so Ben, let's just start off. You are the CEO of BlueJay, the company. Can you just tell us a little tiny bit about that? And then we're especially interested in starting talking about the predictive model you have where you predict tax court cases. So tell us a little bit about BlueJay, and then let's talk about this these predictions, the forecasting you do.
Sure. So BlueJay is a tax research technology company founded back in 2015 here out of the University of Toronto. I'm a tax law professor here. We've been at this now for over 8 years and leveraging machine learning and different AI techniques to give our customers radically better insights into tax law. And so BlueJay's mission is to basically bring absolute clarity to the law everywhere and on demand. And we think the area that is most demanding of that clarity is tax law. And it's not least because it's my really intense personal academic interest in the subject. I think it's also objectively quite arguable that tax law is most in demand of clarity.
Okay. So we talked in the last episode about a ChatGPT-like tool where you could ask it tax law questions and it would provide the answers.
And we tested it out and it worked pretty well.
And I've used it since then for actual like real world use cases where something came up and I want to know more about it. But
did it give you the right answers?
That episode, you
Hang on. Did it give you the right answers?
It was a lot better than had I not done it.
Which means it's better than Jeff's brain. Okay, so that's good.
Which I think is kind of the goal. I don't think it ever purports to be like 100% accurate and like be the final answer. It's a tool. And if you're better off than had you not had it, then it worked.
So I tried it also, and in the cases that I tried, it also was quite accurate and usefully provided a bunch of sources that I could then go to the actual sources to figure out if it was filling me full of false information or not, and that was very useful. Okay, but that's not what we're going to talk about. That was just sort of a useful thing. So now where are we going?
So that's what we talked about last time. And in the middle of that discussion, you talked about this product that BlueJay has that predicts the outcome of future tax cases. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'm happy to. When we started out with BlueJay, the ambition was to create a system that could answer any tax question. And basically, anticipated by 8+ years where the technology is really clearly going now. But we couldn't. So we thought we would start experimenting with IBM's Watson technology at the time. And we tried to train up a system to predict initially, and this was initially as an academic exercise, to predict how worker classification cases would be decided by the courts. And so we hunted down a collection of worker classification cases. And I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with the issue with worker classification, but the issue is basically, is a worker appropriately treated for tax purposes as an employee, or should they be treated as being self-employed or an independent contractor in the lingo? And someone who is an independent contractor is carrying on business under their own name, and then they have their own business, they have business tax obligations. If you're properly characterized as an employee, of course, there are a whole different set of tax consequences that flow from that. And famously, I think in tax, worker classification is really difficult because it's a multifactorial test. The IRS has 20 different indicia of worker classification status. And we thought this is a great test bed for figuring out if we can leverage machine learning and AI to make predictions about how these cases would be decided. And so we started in on this mostly out of academic curiosity to see if we could actually do this. And, you know, it worked not very well for quite a while. We tried lots of things that didn't work, but the ambition was to predict on a given factual scenario, what would a court actually decide on those facts.
So like what were the, you said it was a good like test case. What was it about worker classification that made it a good case? Is it like a lot of case law to go from? Is it that there were these different tests or something about the regs? What is it about it that makes that a good place to start?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's a known unknown. So it's a decision point where you'll often get to, when I teach introductory tax here at the law school at the University of Toronto, we spent an entire class on worker classification. So this is a 2-hour lecture talking about, you know, the case law and the different ways, the different indicia that courts look to in classifying workers. And you know, you can identify for every given factual wrinkle, like which direction it points to, but usually law students, and I'm sure accounting students, find it extremely frustrating to not to be told, well, it all depends on the total relationship between the parties. And so you kind of have to squint at the entire situation and then exercise your judgment and make a judgment call about whether this particular relationship between this hiring party and this working party should be classified as employer-employee or independent contractor and hirer. And so because it's so frustrating to students, I thought this is a really nice testbed to see whether machine learning can add additional value over human analysis. So what happens if we take hundreds and hundreds of cases that have been decided by the courts on this worker classification question, feed it somehow into an algorithm, train up the algorithm on that pattern of facts and circumstances and the linked results, and see if we can predict on new cases how those cases would be decided by the courts. And what we found was out of the gate, it wasn't particularly good. We tried a whole bunch of different things, and we found if we put enough structure on the facts and circumstances, so actually did a whole bunch of work in annotating the facts and circumstances for the purposes of building this massive data set of all of these cases, all the results. It then turned out that we could predict with significantly better than 90% accuracy how the courts are deciding those cases in novel situations. And so we tested that in a couple of different ways. I'm happy to go into that.
Oh, when you say that you like coded up, so did you say, okay, for every case there's, you know, 100 different items and I'm going to code them up as either like a binary variable or some continuous variable, and then this goes on. So it did require you to decide what items you think mattered.
Exactly. And so it wasn't as if we weren't with guidance from the courts about what matters, right? So this is a pretty structured exercise. It's about reading a bunch of cases where the judges talk about the applicable legal test for conducting this exercise. And so the judges will say, these are the kinds of things that we look to in deciding on the classification. And they talk about the facts and circumstances that are feeding that discretion that they're exercising in those cases. And so it was it was kind of a qualitative exercise. So collecting dozens of these leading cases that have a really good discussion of what matters as factual inputs into this classification, and then identifying the kinds of questions that would fill in those circumstantial blanks, right, for an arbitrary new situation.
Does all of the prediction require that you quantify it beforehand, or is there anything where you can just like feed it a whole bunch of text? Like, here's the argument from one side, here's the argument from the other side, who's going to win? I mean, it's a very different thing where you know what matters as opposed to like letting some kind of algorithm or machine or whatever figure out what matters.
Yeah, and I think with Ask BlueJay, which is our new product, I think it's much more flexible with these large language models and massive corpus. We're talking about, you know, hundreds of thousands of documents feeding this. It's a different way of approaching research. This older way is it's really leveraging supervised machine model, machine learning. So it's a bespoke model. It requires a bunch of data collection, data cleaning, and building the best parsimonious model of how judges are actually exercising their discretion. One thing you said earlier is pretty much spot on. So we'd start with several dozen different, you know, in machine learning circles, they'd be called features, like identifying all these different features of the facts and circumstances that are, you know, candidates for being important in driving the outcomes. And then it was an exercise between the data science team and the legal research team. The legal research team would go through, annotate all these cases, identify all these different features for the case law, you know, pump that data set over to the data science team. And they would understand, they would like do a whole bunch of work to figure out what's actually driving the results. And sometimes really interesting things that judges seem to talk about a lot don't really matter in how they're actually deciding, and more like other things get loaded up. So in terms of explanatory power. And so it's about dropping different features that aren't part of, you know, the most parsimonious model, because you want to avoid overfitting of those models. And you want to make sure that you're asking a sufficient set of questions to get at the things that really matter for the results. But you don't want to also burden somebody with having to answer 100 different questions about the facts and circumstances before they get their predictive result when they're using the platform.
So that seems like it's quite labor intense. Is the idea behind Ask BlueJay, like the new large language model that you guys are using, will it eventually like make your old prediction model obsolete? Is that kind of where this is headed?
Yeah. So I think what's going to happen is we're gonna have the two platforms kind of dovetail into each other. So the part of the R&D work we're doing now is how do we leverage these predictive models, the supervised machine learning models that we've built over the course of several years. We've got dozens of them. They're really, really good at specific kinds of issues where we do have hundreds of litigated cases and we have decisions to train those models on. How do we knit those into the Ask BlueJay interface, which is really clean? It's basically, you know, a very familiar interface where you can just type in any tax query. So to extend that to the worker classification setting, it could be somebody says, well, can you tell me if a worker who has to wear a uniform and is assigned specific hours of working and can't work for any other hirer is an employer, an independent contractor? You can imagine Ask BlueJay saying, it looks like you're really interested in a worker classification question. You know, happy to help. Can you answer the following several questions in order to fill out the facts and circumstances so I can give you, you know, the best possible answer here? And so what you need to tell me is you know, this and that? Can you, you know, subcontract or delegate any of the work? Who owns the most appropriate tools or equipment? You know, what, how is the money actually separate? Who's taking the financial risk? Like, you can imagine the system trying to elicit additional information and then saying, okay, based on all of this, we think there's a, you know, Ask Blue Jay is saying, there's an 86% likelihood that this kind of worker is going to be classified as an independent contractor based on the existing case law. And here are some of the most similar cases that have been decided. I think that's where this goes.
So that's kind of cool, because that I think is a little more interactive than at least like ChatGPT or whatever I played with, where you ask ChatGPT a question and it gives you an answer, whether it's right or wrong. And then what you're saying is you might ask a question and it might write back to you and say, that's a great question, but I don't have enough information. Give me this information. And then the large language model will feed the data needed to your predictive model. Did I understand you correctly?
Yeah, that's how I envision this going. Yeah. I think it's kind of how, you know, tax people already operate with their clients. So a client comes in and sees you and, you know, they're like, hey, I've got this problem. Can you help me? And you're like, I'd love to help you. I need to understand more about your situation. Let me ask you a bunch of questions, do, you know, client discovery work, make sure, you know, you properly understand the problem. Sometimes clients aren't able to articulate precisely what their problem is. So one of the big things that we do in law school is, you know, let's unpack precisely what are the issues here for this particular client? What do they really need to be thinking about? I think this is where a lot of this, you know, technology goes.
Is this where TurboTax is headed? I mean, I don't know what they're doing, but I'm just wondering if, like, you know, right now you go to TurboTax and it'll be like, okay, list out your dependents. And like, you're basically just inputting a ton of information. And then it says, I think you should do this. Like, is there a world where like filling out your tax return is going to be sort of more like you're doing an interview with a computer that's a little more fluid than like just fill out forms?
It wouldn't surprise me at all. Like, it seems like the technology is ready. I mean, Scott, at the limit, of course, you know, we know that a whole bunch of tax administrations are interested in making their tax systems pretty much entirely, you know, return free, right? Like, let's just take that burden out of the you know, the run of the mill taxpayers' hands entirely. Whether we're talking about, you know, the Michael Gratz proposal to, you know, do away with 100 million excess income tax returns that are filed by, you know, bumping up the basic personal amounts that, and, you know, raising the ceiling or the floor for taxable income, or, you know, just even just having pre-filled tax returns, as, you know, California proposed to do and then, you know, backed away from, and, you know,
so, H&R Block got too much influence.
Yeah. you can totally imagine those kinds of systems, being introduced and then, you know, and maybe having a bit of an interview process, like with an agent that just basically confirms that you do qualify for just being, you know, having that pre-filled return being sufficient. So questions around, do you have other sources of income that, you know, fall outside these boundaries? And if so, what are they, how much, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's very cool.
So what would the use cases of this prediction be? Is it, I mean, this is like clients deciding whether or not they should just like settle if the IRS wants to audit them, or where is this useful? I mean, it's really cool to be able to say, we can predict it. So it's, you're going to be an employee with 97% and that's accurate, but when would you use this in the real world?
So there are a whole bunch of different settings, Jeff, for sure in the dispute resolution context. So, you know, you're under audit, you know, there's some kind of question about the treatment of a worker or any number of things, right? Because we got dozens of these different models. For sure in the dispute setting, it tells you whether you should kind of concede a particular point, whether you should fight a particular point, what terms of settlement might be fair, even just informing the kind of advocacy posture, like what would I have to demonstrate on the facts and circumstances to get to a position that's really strong? And so what's the case I have to make looking at the potential evidence that I could adduce if this were to go to court? So that's one use case. That's way down the line. Like, another use case is at the very start, right? So somebody comes to you and says, hey, Jeff, I want to start up a a beautician shop and I want to hire all these beauticians who are going to work, I'd prefer to have them be independent contractors. How do I set up the contractual relationships with these beauticians who are going to be working in my shop to make sure that they're independent contractors and I don't have to get into all this payroll stuff and payroll taxes and whatever? Sure, we'll do that for a few of the principals, but like, how do I set this up?
That seems especially cool because you could not only, it would be easy to set it up in a way that for certain they would be,
right?
But that might be more costly that you could like, the model could tell you, well, here's a few things you could relax. It would actually make it cheaper to hire these people, lower the cost of having these people, and you'd be pretty sure they could be employed. You could like tinker around and like get the most mileage for your employing dollar.
Yeah. And it's also, it's valuable if there are questions raised sometime down the road, you'd be like, well, we did our due diligence here at the time that we put these contracts into place. Here's the opinion that we produced. And part of the opinion has an attachment of like the Blue Jay Tax predictive report based on, you know, this is what the best state of knowledge was at the time to say that these beauticians are actually independent contractors. And it's giving, I don't know, whatever, 80% likelihood. Like it's like they really should be treated as independent contractors based on the way that the law was at the time, and we would argue still is. And so it can fend off potential challenges down the road.
Okay, so I think so far we've just talked about like clients using it. What if the judge has access to this, the IRS has access to this, and the client has access to this? It seems like you don't even need the judge anymore, and you don't even really need the IRS anymore. You just say, well, here's what the client did this. And in the cases where they were too stupid to ask your tool beforehand, then you just like let the IRS version of this decide the case. And in the case that they had your tool and used it, then there wouldn't ever be a problem. Like everybody would do this. This essentially becomes, this is the tax law. We don't have the Internal Revenue Code anymore. We just have the model, and the model decides everything.
You know what that reminds me of, Jeff? In professional tennis, like, you know, 10 years ago, they created like the challenge system. And so there's human judges making judges. And if you didn't like their call, you could challenge it, right? And then the computer would say, oh, it was in or it was out. And then that got so fast that now almost all the tournaments don't even have human judges anymore. They just have the machine making all the calls. And nobody disputes anything anymore because it just is what it is. And that's exactly what could happen here.
And then the point, the goal, the ultimate evil goal would be to have the black box so complicated that in the background you could like do things to somehow make
nefarious,
nefarious deeds. You control the tax law through controlling the machine, the box. Okay, that's a little bit of a tangent there. But yeah, what if the, you know, the IRS is using this at the same time the client? It seems like it's a weird kind of position to be in.
Well, to be honest, I think this is the pretense that the entire system is already based upon, right? We have a self-assessment income tax system. Everyone's presumed to know tax law from top to bottom. You don't get a break. Like everybody is assumed to know the law. You might escape penalties if you're mistaken and you can show reasonable due diligence, but you're still presumed to know the law. You're still on the hook for whatever the system is going to produce in terms of an overall result. So we're already like, we are assuming that the IRS knows all of tax law. We're assuming that individual taxpayers know the entirety of tax law. And yet we still have this apparatus to ensure that everything is functioning. One thing that makes me really nervous, and Jeff, you know, you're exactly right, where your intuition goes about at the limit, where does this go, is what I would characterize as regulation by machine. And this is that's the title of a paper that I wrote, I co-authored with some of my colleagues here at the law school at the University of Toronto back in 2016, I think, and just kind of exploring like, how does this actually play itself out? It makes us a little bit nervous, maybe a lot nervous, to do that and not have the open loop of the courts to allow for the evolution and the continued development of the law. Because what you're proposing is kind of a closing of the system, and it reduces the amount of learning that can go on in the system. And so I like the idea of still having the ability to go before a judge and make normative arguments about, you know, maybe the case law to date has suggested a certain outcome is most appropriate, but things are changing, or we've learned that this isn't the most appropriate outcome. And so I'd like I'd like you, Judge, to step in and nudge the law in a slightly different direction here because of the following consequences that are going to be visited on me if we go with the previous understanding.
Do you think of the machine, law. And so, would the machine ever get good enough where it'd be like, okay, we write the law and we have, like, let's say there's a judicial system or something, but we write a new law. Nobody really knows what's supposed to happen. The machine learns what the law says. You feed it some information and it says, oh, yes, this one is, you know, yes, this answer is no. And then you feed it enough, a certain type of information. It says, oh, we don't know. Send to judges. Is like, could that happen? Like, is that, you know?
I think so.
Yeah.
I don't see any reason in principle why you couldn't design.
Like if the machine just can't figure it out, it's like, okay, we don't know. There's ambiguity now. Like send that one to the judges and let's let the judges figure it out and then go from there.
But it's not ambiguity that Ben was talking about. It was any deviation from the prior case law. It's like, it could be that using all 100 cases that are similar to this, you could predict with 100% accuracy how things are going to go. But he's saying like now, like times are different. Something's changed. Society values something different. And so the person wants to be able to stand in front of a judge and say, you know, despite the 100 cases suggesting we should get one outcome, you should judge in a different way. The machine can't change its mind. The judge can. And another way to say that is you could bias the judge. You could make the judge violate prior case law. You could kind of look at this from a positive view or a negative
view.
Another
way to think about it is you're just adding, you're weighting different factors in different ways, right? So a machine might be taught to, you know, there's 20 factors, you weight them in a certain way, you come up with an outcome, everybody agrees. But then as times change, we all decide as a society, oh, we actually should weight this one more than that one. And that flips outcomes in some way, right? I don't know. It's kind of amazing to think about in a lot of ways.
So what, I mean, when you wrote this article, I'm looking at it right now, regulation by machine. In 2016, this didn't seem nearly as real as it did now. And that's, I think, mostly because now computers can talk in normal words like we can. Whereas back then we didn't, you know, machines couldn't pass the Turing test, et cetera. It does really feel like you really could have a lot of situations where you just like ask the machine, it'll tell you the answer and you have to do that.
I can totally imagine us deciding to embrace a system that preserves a human in the loop, but only in really extraordinary circumstances would you want that human in the loop to depart from the default answer produced by the machinery of the law. I can totally imagine that. I also think, you know, it reminds me of how I feel, and I've been flying a lot all over North America recently. Every time I get on a plane, I'm really happy to see two pilots in that cockpit as I get on the plane, even though intellectually I understand that the autopilot systems, the flying by instrument systems are extremely good in these large commercial aircraft. It's the safest possible way to fly is to fly by instrument. But I'm really glad that there are two pilots in there who are ostensibly really well-trained and have skin in the game. They are going down. If we go down, they're going down with the plane.
We literally just had a case like in the last month where some guy was in that cockpit and tried to override the system to kill everybody on.
Yeah.
You heard that about that case?
No, but it's happened.
The computer won't do that.
Right.
But the guy will.
Right. And so we hear about the cases, you know, of heroic pilots, you know, dealing with the geese who flew into the engines and blew the engines. They land the plane on the Hudson, saving all these people. We celebrate that. We talk less about, you know, the suicide by plane crash, the murder suicide by plane crash, where, you know, the plane goes down with 300 passengers and everybody loses their lives. I don't know what the net gain is in terms of having those human pilots with the capability of flying the planes. It's arguable that actually having those human pilots makes it less safe on average per passenger mile flown than going purely by instruments. I don't know. This is.
I mean, that for an airplane, that could be the case, but for like a car,
not yet.
Seems like
we're nowhere near that for cars. I totally agree.
No, but I'm saying for a car,
yeah,
it might be more likely to get there soon because of how untrained people are. Like pilots know a lot of stuff. The average car driver, not that great.
Right. But it's tough to kill 300 people with your car.
Yeah.
is the flip
side. Yeah, anyway. I don't know. It's amazing. The whole thing to think about is amazing.
Okay, so you have, so we've talked about worker classifications. Have you predicted anything else? Is there any other like outcome that's very amenable to these prediction models? And then you I mean, we spent most of the time talking about how you did this 5 or 6 years ago. How has that changed in the last while predicting?
Yeah, so we've continued to build these models. There are tons of examples. So I could log into the BlueJ Tax platform and prattle off a whole bunch of them. You know, it ranges from whether somebody can make use of, you know, some reasonability defenses, whether they actually conducted themselves in an appropriate way to make use of some defenses against penalties. It ranges to debt versus equity classification. So in the case of financing instruments, this is a famously fact and circumstances driven area. In the UK, we've built classifiers that are in the VAT space. So things involving the classification of different foodstuffs, right? So they're really interesting.
Is it entirely or partially covered by chocolate?
Yeah, like, and you know, the difference between like whether peanuts have salt on them or not, right? Well, like, it's so interesting and somewhat arbitrary, but there are enough court cases that you can actually train a classification system to do a really, really good job of food classification. So this is useful for, you know, any significant retailer with, you know, a zillion SKUs that they're trying to, you know, figure out the VAT classification.
So, so that case, they could run your classification on all, you know, 5,000 things they have, and they might have misclassified a few of them, and they like might pay a little bit less in VAT or get VAT lowered for their item.
Mm. Yeah. So like there's so many use cases and tax law is replete with these kinds of things where we like, I don't know, we kind of feel like, oh, it's a logical system. It's like very black and white. You've got this intricate, you know, set of rules. There are all kinds of nodes there where it's like insert human judgment about whether, you know, this worker is an employee or independent contractor or this financing instrument is debt versus equity. And I think of it kind of as the junk drawer of tax logic reasoning, because, you know, the real world is messy, but to work with the concepts, you need to kind of like create artificial dichotomies in different places to allow the rules to work. But it just invites a bunch of fighting about those top level nodes all over the place. So wherever these nodes are of discretion, where you could argue, is something a snack or is it a grocery item? You know, it seems like a bit of an artificial distinction, and it is, but you know, we can agree at the limit, you know, Doritos are clearly a snack, and you know, I don't know, like a fresh apple is clearly a grocery item, but like in between, it's hard to know.
So I wonder if the same principle, I mean, I wonder, I'm pretty sure it would apply to not just tax issues, but like if I think about financial accounting, there often are these like managerial judgments that are required to say determine whether or not something is more likely than not to occur, and then that threshold issue pushes you in one direction or another direction for your financial accounts. And you can imagine like the same sort of technology being applied not just in tax but in financial accounting and probably like a million other places. So it's kind of fun to think about.
I think so too. I think, Scott, part of the challenge in that context is where do you get the ground truth? So in at least in tax litigation, we know who decides. It's a judge who decides, and the judge decides, and then the judge is tasked with writing up reasons for that decision and explaining, you know, these are the facts as I found them. And, you know, both parties through this adversarial process had a chance to make representations, adduce evidence, yada, yada, yada. So we've got all these protections. We've got a good record, and then we've got a final result, which is really great training data. I think part of the challenge in GAAP, right, or in financial accounting is like, who's deciding? Like, what's the ultimate, who's the ultimate arbiter, and what's the ground truth data set? Right.
It's the market. So now, but the weird thing about that is it creates a really, really weird feedback loop, because we often use market reactions to determine whether something was A versus B for financial accounting. And then we look at whether or not the financial accounting is more or less relevant to the market participants. But the funny thing is, if you're using the market participants as the determiner of truth and also the party that is using the information, then you have a giant infinite loop, and it is a little weird. Yeah. Yeah. Very, very interesting. I love thinking about this, and it'll be really fun to think where it goes from here. I mean, you mentioned while Jeff was trying to get his microphone to work before we clicked record that there had been quite a few changes even in, since we last chatted, which was only maybe 2 months ago at the most, about with Ask Blue Jay. What are some of the things that, just very briefly, like that have been changing with Ask Blue Jay?
Yeah, so I think in our last conversation we were talking about, you know, the hallucinations and the accuracy level. So we've introduced further changes to significantly improve the accuracy of the algorithm, which is fantastic. We've also made the system fully conversational. So if you're in the system, before it was kind of providing a one-shot answer to each tax research question. Now you can follow up, and the algorithm is going to understand the context of the previous interactions. And so you can really have a conversation with Ask Blue Jay, whereas before you couldn't really carry on a conversation. It would be just a series of, you know, oracular pronouncements by Ask Blue Jay. And now, you know, you can interact with the Oracle. It's got a memory, and it's going to help you through disambiguating maybe what your question is, because one of the things we found is sometimes discerning user intent from a single question can be very difficult. But if you ask an initial question and you get a response, and then you say, no, actually, what I should have added this additional fact X or Y, and then the system can provide a better response to that initial query. So we've made it conversational. So on the algorithm side, we've got these improvements, greater accuracy, conversational capabilities. On the content side, I'm really excited that we've concluded a deal with Tax Notes to include all of Tax Notes Federal, Tax Notes State, Tax Notes International, all of this content into the Ask Blue Jay platform. And so this content is going to be informing the answers that Ask Blue Jay is producing. You know, our hope is internally by the end of January 2024. So just a couple months from now, we should have this up and running in the platform. But this is a massive trove of information, really great commentary and analysis.
Is that excluding like the commentary and opinion? I mean, because you can write just like opinions how you wish the world were, and Tax Nuts will publish.
Jeff is imagining. Jeff is imagining stuff, right? The noise that will be included in Ask Blue Jay because of the articles he's written in Tax Notes.
Yeah, all my articles, they should be excluded from the training, so that's for certain.
So this is something that we need to work with over the next couple of months and see how it affects things. My own suspicion is that there will be things that really contribute significantly to the accuracy and filling out the context for the Ask Blue Jay algorithm. And then there will be things that, you know, obscure or confuse the analysis as well. And so the trick will be figuring out how to tune the system so that it's drawing the maximum amount of signal out of that information and minimizing the amount of noise that that's contributing.
And maybe this is too personal and you don't want to share, and we can just delete this question then if it is, but if not, so it seems like Tax Notes is giving you this giant, very valuable thing. What do they get in return? Do you just like pay for this data, or is somehow Ask Blue Jay going to be embedded in some Tax Notes product, or?
This is part of the bargain, the commercial bargain that we've struck with Tax Notes. The one of the key things for our users to understand is while we'll be drawing on the Tax Notes material and producing the answers, if you want to read the full text of the Tax Notes article, we will link you. We'll point you directly to the exact Jeff Hoops article in Tax Notes that you should be reading. If you want to go deeper on a particular issue, you can click
more
that.
Shallow with my articles.
You can, or if you just want to amuse yourself by reading it, you can click on the link. It'll take you out. If you're already logged into Tax Notes, it'll take you just directly to the article, and you can carry on your analysis immediately. If you're not a subscriber, it's great for them because it's pointing people to look at this valuable content that you do not have access to. If only you subscribe to Tax Notes, you'd have access to this really phenomenal content, and you'd be able to go deeper on this thing that you're right now researching, and it's really key. It's on point for what you're doing. And so it makes a ton of sense for them to have their content deployed in Ask BlueJay so as to point more people in real time to that content without like putting it outside the paywall so that, you know, Google is going to index it all. And then like that doesn't really work. This is a really nice way for them to, you know, enhance the value of the tax note subscriptions for those who are already subscribers and also give others a chance to discover the value of that content.
Yeah, it's amazing. Thank you, Ben, so much for coming on today and telling us what's going on at BlueJay Tax.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to chat with you guys. Maybe we'll have to do a part three at some point
yeah.
and really make history here.
I think that's a definite possibility. I'm Scott Dyring. This has been another edition of Tax Chats. I'm joined, as always, by Jeff Hoops, my colleague at the University of North Carolina. And our guest today has been Ben Allery, who is CEO of BlueJay Tax and professor and Osler Chair in Business Law at the University of Toronto. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll chat with you next time. Goodbye.
Bye.